Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Charlotte's Got a Lot. The Queen City is a food lover's paradise and host to hundreds of incredible events throughout the year, including the International Symposium on Bread. Learn more at charlottesgotalot.com.
Ever heard of a popcorn-driven robot? This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you stories about the intersection of food and tech.
We're interested in building swarms of many cheap, small robots and powering them and driving them forward with as little effort and as little energy as possible.
We cover tech by land.
Imagine if you could cut fresh microgreens onto your salad and eat it while the greens are still fresh and nutritious and delicious and alive. That dream is real.
We cover tech by sea.
We're building software-based business services to help shellfish growers manage and grow their business.
And we cover tech in the social media stratosphere.
So it's not really necessarily an indictment on food media or for media consumption at all. It's really, it's how the robots decided that they were going to weight human interaction.
Tune in and get techie this week on Meat and Three, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Allie Kane. Welcome to In the Sauce, a new podcast about building food brands. We live in a culture that romanticizes entrepreneurship and the hustle, but what I really want to hear are the stories from the trek uphill. And I want advice in real time. This is the story of Haven's Kitchen Sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand, because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm happy to be speaking with Kara Posner, our sauce attorney from the Januzzi Group. Note to all entrepreneurs, do not skimp on legal. You will need it. Hi, Kara.
Hey, Allie. How's it going?
It's going well. So a little bit about you. You grew up in Florida. And were you one of those little girls who was like, I rest my case? Like, were you a little legal eagle from childhood?
I actually was not. I did not get interested in going to law school until my third year of college. Uh-huh. I was a major in advertising, and I've always been very into brands. Yeah, it sounds like I might have wanted to end up and planned to end up where I am, but it's actually, you know, it's a very lucky story I have. Went to law school in Florida, had a job offer in Florida, but happened to meet a guy in law school that's now my husband. So. Oh. Kind of followed him a bit up here and really was just happened to fall into the Januzzi Group. They had just broken off from a bigger firm.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Januzzi Group at the time or now? Or, yeah. You know, because there, I did not know that. I knew there were like medical lawyers and, you know, business lawyers and DAs, but I didn't really understand how many different sort of subsets of lawyers there are. So. Specifically.
Yeah. So I think we're a little bit unique in that regard. There's a lot of, you know, versions of us in the tech world. Mm-hmm. There's tech specialty firms and, you know, like you said, there's medical lawyers and what have you. But our firm and our practice grew out of the experience of Nick along the way with Vitamin Water in the late 90s and early 2000s. And then just sort of, you know, stumbling into this space and becoming such an expert in this space that we really tried to keep our focus only in food and beverage and wellness. And, you know, it kind of happened very organically in the beginning when the firm first started in late 2010, early 2011. Mm-hmm. It was, I think we had about 30 clients and, you know, we were at the trade shows. We were kind of out there looking for clients.
Right. And looking for emerging brands.
Looking for emerging brands offering, you know, a unique set of skills and experience, not only, you know, legal work and the ability to be your attorney, but also to, you know, lend insight into what you should be thinking about as a brand as you grow.
Right.
And, you know, what are the legal pitfalls that we saw, at least in Vitamin Water's case and in the many other clients that Nick was representing at the
right.
time. You know, but since then, that was 7 years ago, 7, 8 years ago, it's evolved into a practice that's, you know, now we have over 1,000 clients.
Wow. I think. And you still pick up my phone call.
Yeah. You're one of our favorite clients.
Oh, cool. Thanks, Kara.
Yeah. No, I mean, 1,000.
Smallest, but favorite.
Yeah. I think we work actively with about 300 clients a month, so they're not always talking to us. But
right.
Yeah, no, it's been a very organic growth, something that we're very proud of.
And it makes sense that you love brands.
Yes.
And do you remember, because, I mean, I think back, I've always loved brands.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the way that a brand can sort of tell its whole story, either just like in a logo or in a theme song or anything. Did you have brands when you were little that you loved, that you remember?
You know, that's a tough question, but loving brands generally always was a thing of mine. I mean, I majored in advertising in college, like
right.
I said, and I really like the way that a brand has to figure out how to communicate with its audience.
Right.
And I think that, you know, I feel so very lucky to be in a position where I'm still sort of doing that in a way,
yeah.
but helping, you know, a brand protect itself
right.
in that process.
And then when did law school come on the horizon?
My junior year of college, I'll be very honest with the reason I had an internship at what was considered the best agency in the Southeast. And I was working for an art director who I thought was ancient at the time. She was probably 32.
Right.
And I asked her candidly, I said, how much money do you make? And she told me, and, you know,
that's when you decided to be a lawyer.
I did. I come from a very, loving family, but not a family that was always very financially stable. So I had, you know, I had a background involved that was leading me in a different direction.
Right.
And, you know, so I made the decision for that reason, for financial stability and things like that. And that's why, like I said, I feel so lucky to have ended up still being able to do what
yeah.
I spent 4 years of my life studying.
Totally.
In a way.
It's funny. It's like a perfect job for you.
Yeah. No, if I could go back and rewrite the story, it would be that I always intended to be
right.
a Genuzzi Group lawyer, and here I am.
But, right. And then you have a 2-year-old.
I do.
And I, from what I understand, you were like giving birth and also, I don't know, doing legal things at the same time. Like
yeah.
the word on the street is that you, you're quite a powerhouse and you did not slow down.
I did not slow down, but for a little bit of time to spend some time with her and
right.
my husband at home, and then very much looked forward to coming back. I did have a fear before having a child just because I don't know what that's like
yeah.
before it happens.
Well, Cardi
but,
B, this yeah. past week, she was like, it's real,
yeah,
this
yeah.
baby thing.
No,
yeah.
and I thought, well, you know, what if I don't want to come back, then what?
Right.
You know, I've done this, and I knew within 2-3 weeks, I was like, this is great, but
yeah.
you know, I love working, I love helping clients, and I especially love the people that I work with, which I
right.
think is, you know, vitally important.
No, that's amazing. So we were talking a little bit before we went live, and I guess, you know, my overarching question before we kind of get into the nitty gritty, it, you know, basically when we started the sauces, my only thought about legal was that I needed to do sort of a separate LLC. And I had a wonderful attorney who helps us with Haven's things, and he kind of did that. And I figured off to the races, and we won't really need like any big guns for a while.
Right.
And pretty much like week 3, all of a sudden, you know, we called you.
Yeah.
So those early issues that, you know, if you're starting off and you are planning to launch a product, what are some things that we need to know or that we forget or that we don't even know that we don't know?
Right. Well, I mean, it sounds like you did the right first step in that you talked to an attorney about what entity you wanted to be in the first place.
Right.
We have a lot of clients.
That was one of my questions, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, we've traditionally been huge fans of the LLC because it allows for, LLCs are creatures of contract. Corporations are more creatures of statute, and there's a lot of rules and a lot of procedures, whereas LLCs, it's, you know, basically whatever you draft in the operating agreement can be your structure. And so we like that a lot from a legal perspective. It puts founders in positions to keep themselves in control, mm-hmm. even beyond, you know, majority ownership or whatever. But yeah, one of the first things you should do is ask, what entity should I be?
Right.
And I think in order to assess that, you should talk to an attorney or at the very least an accountant. And decide. Like I said, we love LLCs, but there are some compelling reasons to be a corporation as well. And those are things you should explore. And, you know, if you've already formed an entity, that's okay. Still talk to somebody and figure out whether you made the right decision. One thing I will say, that if you're an emerging brand, and we've had a few clients come to us, we don't understand the S-corp structure and why that would ever be a choice.
Right.
Mainly because they
hashtag no S corp.
Hashtag if unless you're going to keep your, you know, company as sort of a profitable standalone operation that you want to pass on to your kids, probably not an S corp. They have a lot of restrictions in terms of shareholder base. You cannot bring in entities, so that's pretty much every private equity fund,
right?
And you cannot sell preferred stock, which, you know, again, could exclude a lot of opportunities.
Are those the three options, basically, corporation, LLC, and S-corp?
Yes. There's also a growing number of states, including Delaware, are enacting, I think they call it public benefit corporations, which is kind
like
of...
B-corp?
Yeah. B-corp's a private organization that does certifications, and I think they've done a lot of great work to actually push for legislature that matches what they're trying to do on the private level. So it's almost like, you know, they go hand in hand. And I think even now, I haven't done much B Corp research recently, but I think their website now says that if you are in a state that has a PBC option, within 2 years or whatever, you'll actually finish that step.
Oh, wow.
So they kind of go hand in hand, but B Corp was a private way of kind of, you know.
And why what's the Delaware thing? Why is everyone like, do it in Delaware?
Every time I drive through Delaware and I see their nice, pretty roads and everything, I think you're just scamming every business in the whole world. No, we love Delaware, but the real reason is it's historical, you know, it's history-based. Delaware was sort of the first state that really... kind of built the body of corporate law via case law, and had the best and the first sort of corporations code and LLC Act and all that. And it's, you know, they're just, you know, they're scamming us. No.
Right. I've never been there, but you know, I feel like everyone and their brother is incorporated in Delaware.
Yeah, no, Delaware's great. It's all a matter of just how the case law evolved and how the legal atmosphere evolved, and they were really first to everything and have built upon it since then. So
once you decide what you want to be, hopefully with the help of an attorney, then
I think the next biggest issue is division of ownership. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many clients have come to us and say, you know, I own 80% and I've got two co-founders that each own 10% each. We formed the company 3 years ago. And we say, okay, well, where's the documents that show that? Well, you know, we've been working every day. We haven't. You're our first lawyer. We're hiring you now.
Right.
You know, what about the tax returns? Well, I mean, I formed the entity, so it shows me as owning 100% the last 2 years. But you know, they really own. You know, just things like that. If you want to give co-founders equity, sort of day one, we call them day one people.
Right.
You know, that should be settled right away.
Right.
And you know, a related question is whether those, you know, folks should also be subject to some sort of work requirement. You know, are you giving away 10% to a so-called co-founder who's not really going to show up like you will?
Right.
And that's different than employee equity. That's separate.
Right.
And that's something that comes later. But yeah, dividing up the company in the way that it should be and documenting that early is very, very important.
I do feel like friends I have given co-founder status and a big chunk of equity to someone they think will be either like great networking or, you know, sort of helpful to have them involved in some way.
Right.
And there are definitely times where people sort of wish they had that chunk.
Definitely.
Back.
Yeah. I mean, when you're talking about 10 to 15%, I mean, like we were saying before the show, that's what you should be setting aside for like your entire employee and service provider base from start to finish, you know?
Right.
So if you give someone that much off the bat for, you know, maybe being around, it's, you know, it's something you need to think about, but it's sensitive issues because a lot of times, you know, these are your friends or even your family members.
Right.
But I think the general rule is whatever you intend and whatever the group intends for it to be, just document it, you know, concurrently with when that decision is being made.
Right. Okay. So that is there, are there more sort of don't mess this up early on stuff?
You know, I think after forming the right company and, you know, papering your equity, I think the very next thing has to be, you know, who owns your product? Did you get the idea from a friend? Did you hire a third party to sort of make something in the lab?
And, interesting.
And did they develop a formula for you? If they did, that's great, but you need to make sure you have a document that says that, you know, for this money that you paid me or this service or whatever, you own everything that I've created for you. We've had a client come to us within the last couple of years, a few actually, and we say, well, give us all your documents. We'll see where you stand on this or that. And there's a formula agreement or a research and development agreement in there that says, you know, your three SKUs are made by XYZ company, and we, the developer, own them.
Yeah.
Period.
So they don't own their company at the end of the day.
No.
Or they don't own their product.
They don't own the product. I mean, every step of the way you have to be thinking, is what I'm creating, can I sell it? Can I give it away myself?
Right.
And here, you know, this is something that thankfully we caught, and you know, they approached the developer and there was a small settlement, and it wasn't that big of a deal, but it's something that if that contract had sat and collected dust for 5 years and then you're going to sell, you know, that contractor could come out of the woodwork and say, hey, you just sold something I own.
Right. That's,
you know,
crazy.
I actually should have all of that money.
So, I mean, it's funny because I had our graphic designer on a couple of weeks ago, and her sort of the main takeaway I got from my time with her was bring graphic design in earlier, you know, and I think what I'm getting from you is like bring legal in earlier. Like, it's, you know, these are all decisions that are slightly awkward,
yes,
you know, and especially as you said, when you're dealing with friends and family, and even when you're dealing with people who are helping you make something, mm-hmm, even if they aren't friends or family, you want to look like you're coming from a place of trust. You don't want to seem like you're litigious. Like, we have a couple of service providers that don't like to operate with contracts. And we feel very strongly that we need to operate with contracts.
Right.
And it's not because we don't trust anybody. It's just because at this point we've had enough sort of not operating with contracts that we feel like we need to. And it can be a difficult conversation to have, but it's worth it.
It is difficult. It can be awkward, but it's always worth it, especially when you're talking about a logo or, you know, a design or a slogan or anything like that. I mean, I can't tell you how many deals we've done, even just in the context of like normal investments where an investor's doing due diligence and they see that somebody created something and there isn't sufficient documentation showing that they conveyed the ownership to the company. It's very awkward to go back to that person who maybe you paid $5,000 at the time,
right,
to say, hey, you know, this agreement isn't quite up to par. We're getting this huge investment and they'd like you to sign this, because, you know, sometimes in the rare situation, it turns into a shakedown.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's an unnecessary tax on the business. You know, you can just take care of that, you know.
Is there anything, first of all, I guess, like, and how would someone, I mean, I was fortunate enough to have friends that knew you guys. But how does someone go about finding, what kind of attorney does someone, you know, I have this great cookie and I'm like, I have my formula and I've got my packaging and, you know, I met Whole Foods at the fancy food show and they want it and I'm ready to go. And now I need to like figure out my legal stuff. Who, you know, how does one go about finding that attorney and what kind of attorney are they looking for?
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about the governance and the corporate stuff and the equity issuances and making sure all that's buttoned up, I think there, you know, any corporate lawyer can help you with that.
Right.
The only problem that you could encounter in that situation is that corporate lawyers generally may gloss over some things that are important in this particular space. For example, we've seen clients come to us with operating agreements that other lawyers have drafted, competent lawyers, sometimes big firms.
Right.
And in the back of the provision, or in the back of the agreement, there's a provision that says you can't amend this agreement unless you have the unanimous consent of the members. And you've got some member in there that owns less than 1%. And the idea that in order to raise money and bring a new investor in, you have to go get this person's signature, it's crazy.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean the corporate lawyer was a bad lawyer.
Right.
It's just they're not thinking about it from the, you know, from the view of, well, this company's going to raise money four or five times and eventually try to sell.
Right. Because this is really, I mean, this is not just legal. This is like legal when it comes to building a scalable, exitable brand
at
the end of the day.
Yeah. And that's where we think that we differentiate ourselves a lot, because we just have so many reps doing the same thing over and over again for different types of products. And we've seen the mistakes, and they're all the same mistakes.
Yeah.
Occasionally you'll get a crazy one, but you know, the things that can be avoided just with, you know, a more strategic eye on the contracts you're executing along the way.
Okay. So we're going to take a little break. And when we get back, I'm going to ask you about 1,000 very specific nitty gritty legal questions. Okay.
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 Sounds fun.
This episode is brought to you by Charlotte's Got a Lot. The Queen City is a food lover's paradise and host to hundreds of incredible events throughout the year, including the International Symposium on Bread at Johnson & Wales University. HRN went to this year's symposium to learn about the science, history, and art of bread making. Here's what visitors had to say about the symposium.
I love the geeky science stuff.
Great food. Love the Armenian pizza.
How much I'm eating.
And consuming the carbs.
The most interesting thing is just the community.
For me, it's the science of starters.
So much information.
Very inspiring so far, because everybody has a different outlook.
I'm not technically a breadhead, but I think I'm going to be one after being here.
So whether you're a breadhead or just a curious mind, check out HRN On Tour for coverage of Charlotte's International Symposium on Bread and an insider's look into Charlotte's food scene. Don't miss our interview with Peter Reinhart and Kristen Moore to learn more about where to eat on your next trip to Charlotte, a city on the rise. Learn more at charlottesgotalot.com.
I'm Moxie Rosenblum. My dad, Harry Rosenblum, hosts Feast Your Ears on Heritage Radio Network. Right now, HRN is having a summer membership drive. Becoming a member is so easy, and you'll help support shows like my dad's. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer.
Hi, I'm back with Kara Posner from the Januzzi Group, our sauce attorney, and a great one at that. And before the break, you had said something that like alerted me, which is that most of the companies that you have, you know, that come to you sort of after a couple of years have made very similar mistakes. There were a couple of, I think you said,
yes,
wild ones. I'd like to know, first off, you know, because obviously like my whole thing is like reverse engineering anything I can.
Right.
So I ask, what are the mistakes so that I can try not to make them? I'll make different mistakes, no question.
Mm-hmm.
But what are some of those mistakes? And you mentioned a couple of them, but if there are more, and then I'd love to just hear, you know, a doozy.
Yeah, no, I can tell you some crazy stories. So the mistakes that we see, they're not necessarily, you know, the most frequent, but they're the most catastrophic that we see.
Those are good to know.
Yeah. So I think the first thing that you really have to make sure you get right is, we talked about a little bit about your formula and making sure you own your product, but also your trademark and your labeling.
I wanted to ask you about trademark and labeling and the whole TM thing and how to do the right search. And
Well, we actually, our firm doesn't do specialized trademark work, so I can't talk too much about the nitty gritty stuff. But generally speaking, you want to make sure that once you come up with a name or a logo or whatever you're going to go forward with, that you are filing your trademark where you are going to be and where you're planning to expand to. And then even, and a trademark lawyer can help you with this, in countries where, you know, the trademark law is very predatory, and making sure you're buttoned up because, you know, you may be acquired by somebody who is international and, you know, they're thinking a lot bigger than you might. So even if you're not planning to sell in China or whatever, you know, make sure your trademark lawyer is at least looking into, you know, whether the name's available, whether there's anybody who's squatting on it, things like that. And then along the same lines is making sure that your labeling and your website is compliant because there are literally plaintiff's lawyers that spend their days walking the aisles of Whole Foods in California and looking for the new products that pop up and finding a mistake. And if you haven't had your labels reviewed, there will be at least one, probably two or three, and then sending you a letter and saying, my client was damaged and you, you know, you owe this much or I'm willing to settle for this much. And you'll, you know, we have clients come to us and it's not the tiny clients. It's the very established clients sometimes and say, well, what can I do about this? And said, well, you figure out a number and you pay this person because your label's wrong. And those are just things that you can avoid. You know, label review is not costly, but settling a lawsuit like that is.
Yeah. I mean, we, you know, we, very early on, we decided, we said something like we didn't say all natural. We said something like nothing artificial.
Right.
But I guess in Mirin or in Tamari or something, there's a sub, it's alcohol, which is a sub of something, you know, I mean, it got really, and we're like, no, but it took, you know, so we decided to take some stuff off.
Yeah.
And we you know, you can never claim anything that hasn't been certified. I know.
Yeah. There's just so many rules and they're changing all the time too. That's the thing. So, you know,
even about where the things are placed on the package.
Yeah. Where they're placed, the order in which they're named, the font size. I mean, whether you have a certain ingredient requires sort of a more prominent display. I mean, it's a lot of stuff to be thinking about. And certainly the person or the firm that you're hiring to design your labels, number one, their contract's going to say it's not on them anyway.
Totally.
But even if it were on them, they wouldn't know what's going on. So.
I mean, though, I will say, we decided to do, you know, we made these stickers and we just had like our baristas from work just like stickering on the pouches. Mm-hmm. We had no idea we were going to be selling as many as we ended up selling. So we thought that was like a tenable situation, which it turned out pretty quickly not to be.
Right.
But we've already gone through in just a year, three different label, you know, three different packaging. You know, don't commit, I guess. It's worth, this is my note to entrepreneurs, it's worth not buying 200,000 labels and spending less money on the labels. It's worth it to buy fewer labels and be able to iterate and keep changing and adapt, even though it feels like it's a lot of money. And it's also worth it to get the legal advice to make sure that you're doing it the right way.
It definitely is, especially as you start to gain traction. I mean, there's an argument that if you're so small, you know, no one's going to really come after you because they don't see a big dollar sign. But once you start getting a little traction, you will become, you know,
a target.
You will become a target and somebody will send you a letter if your labels are wrong.
Right. Okay. So own your product. Make sure that your trademark and your labeling are tidy. See what you can do about other countries and just make sure that you own as much as possible. And
another big mistake we see is in the manufacturing world. You know, we have a lot of clients that sign exclusive manufacturing agreements, either for a certain territory or sort of just flat out. And those aren't always bad.
Right.
But, you know, you always have to anticipate a situation, always imagine the best case scenario, outgrowing a manufacturer.
Right.
You know, what happens if you place a purchase order for 1 million units and they can only make 500,000?
Right. You and know, they have you in an exclusive and you can't go to another one.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, the natural business-minded person says, well, they can't make it for me, so I'll just engage somebody else.
Right.
And you can do that, but you're breaching that contract. And we have had a couple situations where that happened, and it happened for a very long period of time, and it really was only discovered in the context of a very successful acquisition, and the buyer would not move forward until we contacted the manufacturer, admitted the mistake or, you know, the way we had done business for those 2 or 3 years and, you know, settled.
Right.
Because it did become very, you know, it was a shakedown situation. And the manufacturer had every right to be that way because, you know, they had a contract that was being breached. Yeah.
I've never seen contracts until the CPG world where you cannot get out.
Well,
never seen something like that.
I will say, in the case of that crazy situation, I'm not even sure that the manufacturer intended for that to be the case, meaning right. if you outgrow me, you cannot make somewhere else. It was just a matter of poor drafting.
Right, got it.
And the client who we were dealing with was working with a very sophisticated law firm at the time who did review the contract. And all you needed in there was some language saying, but if we outgrow
then
to the extent we outgrow you, we can go with other people. And I can't imagine at the time the manufacturer would have blinked. I mean, as long as you're buying as much as you can from him, what does he care? That's one thing we see a lot. Another thing we see a lot in the context of manufacturing and distribution is around the concept of assignment, which is usually towards the end of the contract, seems like in the midst of all the boilerplate stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like most contracts say, you cannot assign this agreement without the other party's consent. And in the legal world...
Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So the basic legal meaning of assignment is taking the services you were going to provide or you were going to receive and kind of passing them to someone else. So
got it.
If Haven's Kitchen had a manufacturing agreement and then said, you know what, actually our friend makes widgets, we're going to assign that agreement over to them.
Right.
That's an insane situation. The manufacturer should consent to that. What assignment means sometimes though in the legal world is selling your business, selling all of your assets to an acquirer. So they're
not working for you anymore. They're working for
the acquirer. So nothing's changing, but you know, technically an assignment may be occurring. And what we've seen in those situations, if you don't have a little proviso in there, mm-hmm. which I guarantee every contract you've sent to us now has, is that, you know, you're going to sell your business, either your lawyers or the other side recognizes that there's an assignment consent, right?
Right.
You go to your manufacturer, your distributor, or whoever, and you say, hey, I'm going to sell my business. And again, a shakedown situation because they don't have to give you this.
Right.
They wouldn't have objected to it at the time you signed.
Right.
But now they're in a position of leverage. Right. And it's just one of those silly things that you can generally avoid.
I mean, I now feel like taking every single thing I have and putting it like through the wash at Genuzzi. Like my packaging, all of my contracts, every agreement I have, like I just want you guys to like look at everything and make sure everything is neat and tidy and super cleaned up.
Yeah. I mean, we're happy to do that. I don't know how cost efficient it'll be.
I don't know. I feel like it might be worth it.
Yeah. How much you use a lawyer or us or whoever, it's always a tricky decision. When we first started the firm or, 7-8 years ago, our clients were so small. Some of them were big, but most of them were small, such that, you know, sometimes our advice was don't spend money on legal now. Come back to us, you know, handle your business, grow and come back. But we found that that advice just didn't really work well because by the time they came back to us, so many bad things
had happened to them
along the way.
Right.
That, you know.
Well, that's why it's really nice that you give us, you know, 100 free hours a month.
Exactly.
Just kidding.
Exactly. Pro bono. It's always a tough decision because legal always feels like one of those things that, you know, the money can be better spent elsewhere.
Right. Well, those are two questions like that go hand in hand. One is like, okay, how much should I budget? Mm-hmm. You know, I've already blown through what I thought I would spend on legal in a year for a number of reasons. And secondly, you know, let's do that one.
Yeah.
What's that one?
Yeah. The budget is hard. It's hard to place a dollar amount on it. You know, it kind of depends on what you're planning to do in that first year or whatever time frame you're thinking about. But, you know, what you can do and what lawyers, including our firm, are always happy and willing to do is to give you an estimate. You know, reach out and say, I'm thinking of doing this or here's this agreement. Don't look at it yet. You know, how much do you think this is going to cost in terms of time and you know, billables to review this?
Right.
Because the worst thing that can happen is I say it's going to cost $1 billion and you say, oh, no, thanks. You know?
Exactly.
So,
I mean, that is the second question. What do you think what can we do as founders and entrepreneurs without you early on? And what should we just like never attempt to do without you? Like we're probably going to not make that bad of a mistake doing this, but this could really bite you if you're, I mean, I guess it,
right. I mean,
sort of those things.
Yeah. The best advice that I have, for any founder or the team surrounding the founder is that somebody needs to read top to bottom, every single contract. And I mean that.
Thank you, Katie Carey, is all I can say.
Every word, it's not a fun task. It's like, you know, anytime the new Apple terms and conditions change and that big crazy.
You don't read that.
Nobody reads that, but no.
Okay.
No, I do not read that. But sure. But that's the type of reading that somebody should be doing, because, you know, a lot of contracts that you receive look exactly like that.
Yeah.
And just as intimidating and long. And I think what you'll find is that although the language may appear a little intimidating, it at the end of the day, it's just English.
Right.
Yeah, and you'll understand things as you come upon them. And if you don't, and if something looks weird, then at least you have a narrow issue to send an email to me and say, you know, what is this?
Right. That's a great piece of advice. And I think that's kind of how Katie operates with you a lot.
You know,
we don't just sort of send you things generally.
There's so many things that a young company is doing and a lot of contracts that are coming in and out. I mean, it's hard for us to say what you should and shouldn't send, but you know, if there's anything that appears to be locking you into a really long term, imposing a fee if you want to get out early, exclusivity is a big thing to watch out for, what that means. Are there ways around it?
Mm-hmm.
Non-competes. Anything that appears to put restrictions on you or handcuffs on what you can and can't do.
Even if they're not doing a good job or they're not doing the job that they said they're going to do. And that's what I was saying before. I've never seen a contract like that. Where you literally cannot get out even if it's not going well. You would think that if it's not going well, everyone would want out.
Yeah. I mean, and that brings up a good point too, because, you know, most every agreement, even if it appears, like it has a long term, there's always some sort of termination for breach clause in there. And a lot of people see that and think, if they're doing a bad job, I'll just terminate them for breach. No. That's not how it works. Termination for breach is virtually impossible to prove. It'll just, you know, create a fight. And ultimately, it's just going to end up in some sort of settlement situation, which
will not be good for you.
Yeah. Right. And honestly, that's why some, you know, industry players do impose these sort of long, non-terminable terms. It's not because they actually expect you to stay with them if things aren't going well. It just puts them in a really good position, you know, leverage-wise, if you do want to get out, because it will be a negotiation.
Right. I think you said something like, to prove breach, first of all, you have to give them sort of like, I'm going to try to prove breach now. So even if you have to do that, then anyone can just clean it up for the next 30 days, and then you don't have that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't. I mean, I've actually in 2 days I've been working for Genuza Group for 7 years, and I can't recall.
Congratulations.
Thanks. One situation, not one, where we assisted a client to successfully terminate for breach. It just doesn't happen, because it always turns into a discussion and then a settlement.
Right. Once you've opened that door with the service provider, they know that you're unhappy, and then they can really do some damage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or just neglect you.
Yeah.
Which is doing damage at this point.
Definitely.
So what should, you know, what are some, because not everyone's going to be fortunate, right, to have you guys, but what are some questions that, you know, a new founder should ask when they're sort of shopping around for attorneys? Like, what are some big ones or some red flags that you would say do not sign on with someone if they don't know X?
Yeah. I mean, I would ask a lawyer what they do most, you know, what do they specialize in, day out? For example, if someone came to me and asked me to do their real estate purchase, I would start to panic, and I would feel totally incompetent. And I'd tell them, you know, there's 1,000 other people in this city and much more around the country that can do this job better than me. So I would ask a lawyer what they do.
Right. That's a good place to start.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I'm not a lawyer.
Yeah. It's like going to an eye doctor for a heart condition. I mean,
yes,
you're both doctors, but, it's not the same. So I mean, what do they do? What type of experience do they have in this space? Another thing just to keep in mind is that, you know, the food and beverage industry generally we have found to be very open and very collaborative. So, you know, if you know that a particular lawyer represented a brand, you know, reach out to that founder, see if they're satisfied with their services, you know, including on us, ask around.
It is a very nice community for the most part. So let's go back to the equity discussion, because, so, you know, I think you almost find yourself as a small brand, you know, you need money, right? Most of us are trying to bootstrap it. Mm-hmm. And that's for a number of reasons. One, if you take in a lot of money, you usually don't own a big chunk of your own company. Two, it's hard to get money, you know, until you have a proven concept and at least some sort of proof in sales. So we're always a little bit poor.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads us to making two sort of big financial, probably mistakes at the end of the day. One is bringing in outside money too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is giving away equity to people instead of paying them salaries.
Right.
And so what are your thoughts on, you know, when to bring in that outside money? I know it's not, you know, I understand that you're coming at it from the legal perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So that the outside people, and then what are your thoughts on, you said 10% of the company is reserved for everybody that works, that you're giving equity to, that works at the company and service providers.
Right. I mean, there's no rules, but as a founder, you should try to keep 10 to 15% sort of the cap on day one and looking forward. That can always change. Right. And
which to a layperson, you know, I'm thinking, well, 1% isn't that much. But I mean, mm-hmm. you were like, 1%'s a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And what did you say about CEO? Or?
Yeah, we try to, a lot of clients ask us, well, you know, what should a VP of marketing get? What should this person get? And it's hard to say, on a case-by-case basis. But the general rule of thumb is that, you know, in our view, if you were going to hire an outside CEO, so you're the founder and you're kind of going to take a step back and mm-hmm. you want someone else to run the ship, how much do you give that person? We would say, you know, between 3% and 5% max.
Right.
Crazy circumstances where the company's just drowning and you need help. But
right.
In a normal sort of arm's length transaction, 3% to 5% for a CEO
is
what would make sense.
And in terms of just people, you know, when you want to say thank you mm-hmm. to people who've been very helpful, equity might not be the best thank you. Maybe you should just give them a bottle of wine.
Yeah, send them something. Yeah. Equity as a thank you is tough because presumably that person's friendly and they don't really need it. Equity as compensation when you're, you know, low on cash
right.
can be a very valuable tool as long as you do it right. You know, if you want to incentivize someone to help you out and you don't have the money to pay them,
right.
that's a very common situation.
So maybe equity as incentive versus equity.
Yeah, giving equity as an incentive, putting some vesting metrics on it. You know,
talk about vesting a little bit.
Yeah.
Because you don't just give...
No,
1%.
Do not.
Right away.
No.
Right.
No, don't give away 1% for nothing.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, a typical equity grant for a service provider should have some sort of vesting mechanism going forward. If the person has already been with you for a year and you want to kind of credit them for that, that's mm-hmm. totally fine too. But yeah, we see two different types of vesting most common. One is time-based vesting. And the other is tied to some sort of performance, either company performance generally that this person, you know, may contribute to but doesn't directly control.
Right.
Or, you know, individual performance for, you know, a sales rep.
So if you're giving someone 1%, let's say, even though that's a lot, basically you're saying it will take generally a couple of years.
Yeah, 3 to 5 years is a good
for that 1%
schedule. Yeah, and you can splice it up however you want. You can be as creative as you want. You could say, you know, half of that 1% vests over time in, you know, 12 equal quarterly installments. And then you can say half of it vests, you know, as follows. You know, first when the company hits 5 million in sales, then, you know, whatever you consider success for that person.
And do you think that it makes sense to do it right off the bat, or would you sort of advise like try to lean on the salary bit, or do you think it really does build a better team? I mean, you have a lot of companies that you've watched grow.
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on the compensation package that the person needs and what you're willing to give them. You know, if they have a nice salary, perhaps you can hold back on the equity portion. If you'd like to really incentivize them to go crazy and to really put their all in,
right?
You know, giving them equity is a nice tool. The only thing, you know, you really have to keep in mind is that time is it's always playing a factor. So if you want to give someone 1% or 0.5% or whatever, give it to them, paper it, get it done, because if you come to us a year or two later and say, well, you know, I said I would give it to her, I didn't really get around to papering it yet, you know, there could be tax issues with trying to get them the value that they should have gotten 2 years ago.
I feel like paper it might be like the, the theme of the of the program
Hashtag
today.
Paper it, yeah. But we can go back also to your question about outside money.
Yeah, equity.
Yeah, so that's always a, you know, it varies from case to case, but our general preference, if you can do it, is that the first, you know, financing round you do, maybe even the second or the third, try to get money that is not really going to demand a lot of you. We call it dumb money. It's okay. Not meant to be insulting.
I like that.
It just means, you know, high net worth individuals, friends and family, people who are not going to ask for
monthly or quarterly sort of.
Yeah. Or board seats or blocking rights or approval rights, you know, kind of along the theme that we were talking about earlier. One of the biggest mistakes we see, and this happens a lot, this is the most frequent thing, is that in your first round of financing, you know, a client will give away 2 board seats and 15 blocking rights.
We don't even have a board. Don't you have to have a board to give away board seats?
Well, if you had made this mistake, you would have a board by now. But yeah, just giving away too many rights early, because chances are you're going to need a second and a third and a fourth round of financing. And whatever you do in one round, you're going to do the same or worse in the next.
Right.
And the quicker that control is eroded away, you know, the faster you lose control of the company. And it doesn't ever have to happen, ever. But if it does happen, at least, you know, make it happen slowly.
So it's not even just a question of the percentage of the company that you're giving away, but the control that comes with it.
Yeah. I mean, valuation is one thing.
And how do you, can we talk about that too? Like, people start things, they don't even have a product, and they get, you know, $8 million valuation, $10 million value. I mean, how do you begin to even think about valuations?
Yeah, I mean, valuation is one of those things that can be totally based on nothing or based on, you know, some proof of sales or whatever.
Right.
Ultimately, it's really just negotiation between the company and the investor about how much they want to give away at the time for how much money.
Right.
It doesn't mean the company's worth what they're saying.
Right.
You know, but one risk of imposing a high valuation just to avoid a lot of dilution is that when you go to raise a priced round that is sort of legitimate and is based on what you've done, you know, there's a chance that it could be lower.
Right. Oh, then the got it.
Yeah, and you don't want to have a history of down rounds, they call them.
Right.
Where basically your first investor says, "Wait a minute, you know, I paid way too much. You know, what's going on here?"
So, have you seen in your experience watching all these different brands, are there a couple of things that you now feel like you're like, that one's a winner? Like, what are the indicators to you of someone that's going to be successful, a company that's going to be successful? Or even some like red flags, like not sure how that one's going to eke it out.
You know, I think the biggest indicator that I've seen, and Nick has said this a trillion times, you know, either in the office on the phone with clients or when he's speaking to people, is that, you know, the product is one thing and you have to have a good product, but management is really the key. You know, who's running the company? Are they, you know, all in? Are they dedicated?
Do they have the experience?
Do they have the experience, or even if they don't, or do they, are they terrified enough to know that they know nothing and they're willing to ask questions? And, you know, are they reading the contracts? Are they really caring about the issues? You know, the clients that we see that aren't as successful is, you know, a lot of times have founders that aren't quite as focused, perhaps have other ventures, perhaps are independently wealthy, you know. So I think management is the biggest key that we see.
Right.
Obviously, you have to have a good product as well. But I think a lot of that stems from management.
No, there are a lot of good products out there that just don't make it. I mean, Derek said that about operations, too. There are a lot of really good products out there that just don't make it through because they're not managed well. And by the way, there are a lot of like so-so products out there that somehow manage to kind of crush it.
Yep.
And I think it's because they've been managed super well.
Right.
What's the most fun that you've had doing this job?
Ooh. Work-wise or personal-wise?
Well, we can talk personal after, but I mean, you must get a little thrill when you see a company that you started off with pretty young ending up, you know, selling for tens of millions of dollars or, you know, what are the small victories that you feel?
Yeah, the small victories, I mean, I feel the every day I've ever gone to work, and I mean this 100%, it's I've never regretted walking in the door and thinking, ugh, God, I got to work again today. Every day I'm excited to, you know, help somebody achieve their dream. And so many of our founders have, you know, put everything on the line.
Yeah.
You know, their families are counting on them. Yep. Their houses are mortgaged in some situations, and they're really going for it. So to see success stories like, you know, Chameleon selling to Nestle last year, I was very involved with them for several years. And, you know, Chris is a great guy, and they had a really good team. And so that was a lot of fun. Just seeing people, you know, taking what was an idea and building it, it's very satisfying to see that.
Yeah. It's really fun building something from scratch. It's a lot more complicated.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds so silly to say, like, of course it's complicated. It's never been built before. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, this has been really, really helpful to me. I feel like I probably missed a bunch of questions, but, you know, paper it is issue number one. I just want to thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, definitely. It's been so
awesome.
Much fun.
Yay. Thanks, Kara.
Definitely.
And we will see you next time. I always say that on In the Sauce. And I just want to thank David for once again being the star engineer that he is. There's a lot that goes into making this thing listenable. So I want to thank him again. And I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.